This is Carl. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money.
There's no other developed country with anything like the wealth of renewable energy resources that Australia has.
It's the number one issue facing humanity, and it's the number one issue for me.
Yes, as promised, we're bringing you another instalment of our Tackling Transitions series, and we will next week as well. But we're coming at it from a bit of a different angle today, because in just over a week, as you know, world leaders will descend on Glasgow for the start of the COP26 conference, and the talks will run until about November the 12th. It's being hailed as the most significant climate summit since Paris in 2015, and it's certainly been shaking up national politics here. The question is, why is this particular summit so important? And what exactly does it hope to achieve? I wonder how many of us really understand it, just having heard, we just know it's sort of rattling the cage. Anna Aubrey is a research analyst in the Environment and Society program at Chatham House in the UK, and she joined us earlier to give us a bit of an explainer.
Hello, it's lovely to be with you.
Could we start with that basic question, please? What exactly is a COP summit?
Yeah, so a COP summit is a UN climate change meeting. So every year, the governments of the world, of nearly all countries, come together to jointly discuss how to address climate change. That is a COP, in essence.
And that's been running since 1995, hasn't it?
Exactly. So the one in 1995 was called COP1. And then they all have a number. So we're now at COP26.
So obviously there's been quite a few that haven't had the sort of power or prestige of the big ones like Copenhagen and Paris and Kyoto.
No, I mean, they're all important in different ways, but the ones you point to are the most significant ones. In 2015, we had the Paris Agreement, of course, and the Kyoto Agreement in 1997. But I would definitely put Glasgow as one of the most important COPs ever.
Why?
So we know that to limit warming to 1.5 degrees and avoid the most critical climate change impacts, we need to halve global emissions by 2030. So that's just a few years away. But the emission reduction targets that governments submitted in 2015 when the Paris Agreement was adopted are not at all ambitious enough to get us there. And this is where COP26 comes in, because the Paris Agreement is designed to increase ambition over time. So ahead of COP26, which is now just a week away, governments are supposed to submit updated 2030 emission reduction targets. And the idea is that that will get us there, get us on track for the goals of the Paris Agreement. So COP26 is not about negotiating a new international agreement on climate change. We already have that, the Paris Agreement. This is about implementing that agreement. And in order to do that, we do need to raise the ambition on emission reduction targets, but also on finance, on adaptation to ensure that we reach these goals.
So just to clarify, under the Paris Agreement, countries are actually required, are they not, to bring fresh commitments to the table every 5 years. Is that right?
Yeah, so governments made their first commitments back in 2015. The Paris Agreement sets the overall goals, but then it adopts this bottom-up structure where governments themselves decide by how much they aim to reduce their emissions by a certain year. And the idea is when all these pledges are put together, they will stack up to put us on track for well below 2 degrees, preferably 1.5 degrees. And the difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees may not sound like much, but it really does make a very big difference, especially for the most climate vulnerable communities. But as I mentioned before, the targets that were submitted then, 6 years ago, were not at all ambitious enough. So the COP presidents have been trying to rally all governments of the world to really up their game to put us on track.
So that's where the pressure comes, very much that sense that there's a lot resting on a pledge that amounts to pushing yourself and your citizens of your country.
Yes, they are pledges, but that, of course, needs to be then backed up by concrete policies to ensure that those pledges are implemented. A pledge just by itself is, of course, no good.
What kinds of pledges have we seen so far?
Yes, as of this morning, 114 countries plus the EU27 have submitted a second 2030 emission reductions target. These are also called nationally determined contributions, or NDCs. And yeah, some of these have been relatively ambitious. The UK, for instance, has pledged to reduce emissions by 68% by 2030. The EU is aiming for... No, it is quite... Yeah, it is. That's aligned with 1.5 degrees. And the US has also submitted a target of 50 to 52%. And some more climate vulnerable countries are also showing real leadership, for instance, the Gambia. So we are seeing that progress is made, but we are still very far away from where we need to be, unfortunately.
And then that's where, of course, Australia is standing out, because we haven't set a more ambitious 2030 target. We've stuck, haven't we, to Prime Minister Abbott's target of reducing emissions by 26 to 28% below 2005 levels by 2030, although the view is that we will get beyond that already. So that's where we are in Australia.
Yes, and that's unfortunate. So one would hope that the government reconsiders and really ups their game now in the last few days ahead of Glasgow, because no, it's simply not good enough. And there are a few other G20 countries in a similar position as Australia. Brazil and Mexico, for instance, have not increased their ambition either. And some G20 countries are yet to submit a target at all, well, a second target at all. And that includes China, India and Saudi Arabia, for example. So we do really need, especially the G20 countries, as they account for 80% of global emissions, to step up their game now in the last few days.
Did you say that those countries haven't submitted a goal at all?
No, they have, back in 2015. But now we're supposed to submit the... a second round of NDCs.
Oh,
and some countries, including Australia, have, you know, essentially resubmitted the old target. But some countries have maybe indicated that they will submit a target, but they are yet to do so formally, so to speak.
Look, I understand another aim of this conference is to provide more money to developing countries who are really bearing the brunt of climate change. Now, this was a very important issue at Copenhagen in particular. How is that going to be dealt with in Glasgow?
As you say, that's absolutely one of the most critical issues ahead of and at COP26. More than a decade ago, developed countries promised to mobilize $100 billion per year to support climate action in developing countries by 2020. And I mean, to be honest, this is not commensurate with the needs of developing countries. A lot more money would be needed to solve the climate crisis in developing countries. But it is very important that it is delivered to maintain trust between countries. And so far, this goal has not been met. I mean, a lot of good and promising pledges have been made in recent weeks, but we are still not there quite yet. The governments of Canada and Germany are working on a delivery plan for the $100 billion as we speak, which will show how developed countries will reach this target, because it's not just about delivering it one year. It needs to be delivered every single year from last year up until 2025. And that is due to come out ahead of COP26. So hopefully that document will build confidence, because at the moment, this failure to deliver is creating a lot of frustration among developing countries, and rightly so.
Well, now, there was controversy in the past, Anna, regarding the classification of China as a developing country, which meant that it didn't have to be as ambitious with its climate targets. Is that still the case now?
So it is true that China is still considered what in the climate negotiations are called a non-annex one country, which is, yeah, essentially can be described as developing country. But from an emission reduction target, this classification means less these days than in the past. Before Paris, so when the Kyoto Protocol was the agreement that we had, developing countries were exempt from meeting emission reduction targets. But that changed under the Paris Agreement. So now all countries that have signed that agreement, which is essentially all countries in the world, are expected to, you know, set national emission reduction targets. They themselves decide how ambitious these will be, but all countries, including developing countries, should make them. And that very much includes China, which is, of course, the world's largest emitter. So China is not off the hook, so to speak, on this.
And we still don't know where the Xi Jinping is actually going, do we?
No, the signals that we've been getting in recent days is that he is not attending. On the other hand, I don't think that necessarily should be read as he is not serious about climate change, or he does not think COP26 is important, because President Xi Jinping has not traveled, well, anywhere since the start of the pandemic. China will still be sending a delegation to the COP.
Look, earlier this week, Professor Václav Smil, who is a leading scientist and policy analyst advising Bill Gates, among others, he actually cautioned this week against expecting too much from COP26, and he suggested that reaching the target of net zero will take much longer and be more difficult than most people realise. So after setting out all of the ambitions that you've described and the reasons for it, honestly, what do you think is the likelihood of success at Glasgow? What happens if we fall short?
So if we're thinking of the main aims of COP26 as governments significantly increasing the ambition of their NDCs so that we get on track for the 1.5 degree goal or the Paris Agreement, if it's about delivering on the 100 billion, and then there are also some more technical aspects of the Glasgow agenda, such as finalizing the implementation guide for the Paris Agreement, the rules that will govern implementation that relates to carbon markets. So that's another part. And then there's a discussion around making concrete commitments on coal, for instance, to really get implementation underway. But if we look at those issues as some of the main aims of the Glasgow summit, and then we think of where we stand, I think it's a fair assessment to make at this point that it's very unlikely that Glasgow will achieve everything, especially on the NDCs. We are still very far away from where we need to be. That said, I do think it is really important that substantial progress is made to build confidence about the direction of travel and to lay the groundwork for accelerating action in the years to come, in the early 2020s, because this is really the decade in which we need to act. So governments are in discussions. Exactly how this will pan out is yet to be seen. It's something that needs to be processed in Glasgow. But they're discussing how to respond to a potential gap between the pledges we have and what is needed to align with 1.5 degrees. Yes. And there are lots of ideas on the table there.
Happening, of course, that in the lead-up, there's been this global energy crisis that has seen the UK and China, for instance, ramp up their demands for fossil fuels, and the price of gas, which is always very volatile, just soar, frankly. This is clearly going to have an impact, isn't it, on the conference? It's just people face the practicalities of how you smooth that transition?
So I think it's a bit of a wild card, to be honest. We are hearing that many governments see the soaring energy prices as it strengthens the argument to accelerate to clean forms of energy. So I guess there could be a positive spin to it if governments decide that that is how it should be approached. But yes, as you say, there is a risk that some will use this as an argument to delay action, and that would not be helpful.
Yes. Anna Aubury, maybe we'll talk at the end of the conference and just see how it's all gone. Thank you very much indeed for sort of laying that process out for us. We do appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Geraldine. It's lovely to speak to you.
Anna Aubury is a research analyst in the Environment and Society program at Chatham House in the UK. And I do hope that was useful. For those asking, by the way, what COP stands for, it's the Conference of Parties. And they're the parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And I should also mention, now we did hear today that the Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi, is now going. So several of you have come through sort of listing the people who are not going, New Zealand, Russia, China, but he is now going, which I think is a bit of a small surprise, actually.